pleasure to be with all of you today. It's so nice to come see familiar faces and old friends, and this conference is no exception to that. So I appreciate the invitation. In preparation for our talk today, I pulled some statistics. And the outlook, frankly, is fairly bleak. Homicides hit historic highs in many cities in 2020 and 2021. There was a 2% decrease in the first half of this year in homicides, but the homicide rate is still 39% higher than they were in the same time in 2019. Aggravated assaults and robberies up by 4% and 19% respectively. Property crimes increased by 6%. Larceny up by 20%. Burglaries up by 6%. Motor vehicle thefts up by 15%. These numbers seem anyway to continue to have risen even as we emerge from COVID. So there was a lot of discussion during COVID that COVID's just driving people nuts. That's what's going on here. We are on the other side of that, and these statistics continue to rise. The million-dollar question, of course, is why? And more importantly, what, if anything, can we do about it? Some advocates call for significant reform and restriction of the traditional policing and prosecution model. Others, in contrast, urge more law enforcement. For example, a recent periodical noted the following about a study: that the United States has a higher incarceration rate than other developed countries is well known. Less well known is our dearth of police officers per capita. A new paper by Christopher Lewis and Adener Usmani in the American Journal of Law and Equality finds that if the U.S. were brought into balance with the rest of the developed world, it would have 1.9 million fewer prisoners and 500,000 more police officers. These outlier statistics are related, the periodical opines. Underpolicing leads to high violent crime rates and then to high incarceration rates. The threat of severe punishment does not deter criminal behavior if criminals do not believe that they will be arrested. The paper notes that a single dollar spent on policing is almost 16 times more effective at deterring crime than a dollar spent on incarcerating additional prisoners. So it concludes that for economic efficiency and just simple criminal deterrence, the United States needs more police, not fewer. So, what reforms have been tried and failed? What reforms seem to be producing and bearing some fruit? And what reforms are the jury still out on? Thankfully, we have an incredibly talented group of panelists today to help us answer these questions. I'm going to tell you a little bit about each one, and they'll have to forgive me for the abbreviated version because they're all so accomplished that it could take the entirety of our panel. But I do want you to know a little bit about them because they bring a lot to bear to this conversation. I'm going to go alphabetically. So I'm going to start with Ms. Friel, Jennifer Friel. She's a partner at Jackson Walker's Austin office. She advises businesses and individuals under investigation by the government, and she conducts internal investigations for companies. She was previously an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Texas. She prosecuted cases involving child exploitation, narcotics, conspiracies, gun smuggling, and white-collar crimes. Her practice there focused on appellate matters, defending convictions across the district. She has argued more than 20 times before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and perhaps most importantly, when I was former appellate chief in the Northern District of Texas, she always answered the phone when I called her and I needed to copy her homework on some complex issue. I still am grateful for that, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Before becoming a prosecutor, she clerked for Judge Benavidez. She is the past chair of the criminal law section of the Federal Bar Association and the past president of the Austin chapter of the Federal Bar Association. Welcome, Jennifer. Next, Alexa Gervasi is the executive director of Georgetown Law's Center for the Constitution. After earning her JD from Georgetown Law, she worked as an associate at Quinn Emanuel. She then clerked for Judge Fisher of the Third Circuit and Judge Willett. Following her clerkships, Ms. Gervasi worked as a litigation attorney for the Institute for Justice, a national civil rights firm. In her role as executive director of the center, she's going to oversee all aspects of the center's activities, with an emphasis on originalism outside of academia. Next, and welcome, Alexa. Mr. Shaw. Parak Shaw is of counsel in the Houston office of Gibson Dunn. He specializes in white-collar criminal defense and all facets of governmental and internal corporate investigations. Previously, he served as the acting United States Attorney for the Northern District of Texas. Before joining the Justice Department, he served as Chief of Staff to Senator Ted Cruz and as Chief Counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He handled numerous high-profile congressional investigations and hearings, including the confirmation hearings of Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Mr. Shaw previously served as senior counsel to the Attorney General of Texas and has also held several leadership positions in the Department of Justice, including Deputy Associate Attorney General in the office overseeing the work of the Antitrust, Civil Rights, Environmental and Natural Resources, and Tax Divisions. Welcome, Pri. And finally, a person who probably needs no introduction, Johnny Sutton. Mr. Sutton is a partner and is the partner in charge of Ashcroft's Austin office, which specializes in internal investigations, white-collar criminal defense, and helping companies comply with federal law. From November of 2001 to April of 2009, Mr. Sutton led one of the largest and busiest U.S. attorney's offices in the nation, the Western District of Texas. As U.S. attorney, he managed a large number of employees with a huge budget, and of course, they prosecuted cases from across the spectrum. In 2003, the United States Attorney General John Ashcroft appointed Mr. Sutton to the Attorney General's Advisory Committee, which is a panel of a group of U.S. attorneys from across the country to help the Attorney General carry out his mission. After leading the Bush-Cheney Department of Justice transition team in 2000, Mr. Sutton was named Associate Deputy Attorney General. He held that position until becoming United States Attorney. From 95 to 2000, he served as the Criminal Justice Policy Director for then Governor George W. Bush, and he was the Chief Policy Advisor to the Governor on all criminal justice issues. Perhaps what he's most proud of, at least from my conversations, from 1988 to 1995, he was a prosecutor in the Harris County District Attorney's Office in Houston, Texas, where he successfully tried 17 murder trials, including 7 for capital murder. Welcome, Mr. Sutton. All right, Mr. Sutton, you want to start? Sure. Any opening remarks you'd like to share with the group?
Yeah, it's really true, Judge. My formative years were in the Harris County DA's office. People will sometimes ask me, boy, I bet being a U.S. attorney was your funnest job. That was the greatest job you could ever have. And publicly, a lot of times I'll say, yes, it was. But to be honest, the greatest job I ever had was being a number two prosecutor in the Harris County DA's office in felony court. Zero supervisory responsibilities and trying only murders, robberies, kidnappings, and rapes. I mean, it was, I know that shouldn't be gleeful about that, but it's just, it was an incredible time to try cases. And, you know, that's one of my worries that we'll hopefully talk about today is just how much I learned there. Of course, in the DA's office, I thought, well, every DA's office has a DA like Johnny Holmes, and many of y'all are probably too young and don't know who he was, but he was like he was the Michael Jordan of DAs. I mean, he was a great trial lawyer. He was independently wealthy. He was completely apolitical and just honest, completely honest. And that's what a DA needs to be. And of course, the person that did our training at the DA's office was this guy named Rusty Harden, who at the time we thought was just, he's just a division chief. Little did we know, he's probably one of the best lawyers in Texas, if not the United States. So that was sort of my formative times. I guess my short opening statement would be maybe to have a short history lesson about what things were like back then, how they changed, and how I kind of see them changing now, which is so one of the things I think we're talking about, and one of the things that y'all as future leaders and policymakers and lawyers will be deciding. I started the DA's office in 1988, and let's just say the Texas the revolving door was not only revolving, it was spinning at that time. A 10-month sentence, I mean, 10-year sentence meant 10 months. And a lot of times you would offer, you'd offer 2 years in prison to somebody, and they'd say, they'd come back and say, no, I want three, you know, and I'd say, wait a minute, you want more time than I'm offering? And they had worked out somehow that if you got three, you actually got, you know, transported to TDCJ and immediately released. If you did two, you did it in the county jail and you actually did more time. So that was changed in the early 90s when we built more prisons. We got something called 3G, which is if you committed a crime with a weapon, you had to do 50% of your time. And we just saw dramatic drops in crime. And what we found is that it's really a very small percentage of the population that commits a huge amount of crimes. And if you can identify those people and take them off the streets, and not forever, but for the times when they're young and acting crazy, you can really make a huge, huge difference. And of course, the other thing is we tried cases, and I do worry for y'all how difficult it is to get trials nowadays. I remember when I was at number two, I was in Judge Poe's court. I don't know if anybody knows who Judge Poe is. He was a, y'all may know him as a former congressman, but he was a trial judge, a fantastic trial lawyer. And we tried a lot of cases. 1 year I tried 21 first chair felony jury trials. So I was pretty proud of myself that I'd done that. It was the most in the office. And someone said, don't be too proud when Johnny Holmes was in a court like that, he tried 44 first chair felony jury trials in a year. And I said, that's impossible. I mean, there's only 52 weeks in the year. But they tried a lot of cases, and I think that's one thing y'all need to fight for is those trials. Now, again, obviously we need due process, and maybe some of those were happening a little faster than they should. But the goose that lays this golden egg can be killed, and I'm seeing sort of all the gains that we made in the 90s and early 2000s possibly being lost by thinking, oh, well, we can just not worry about violent crime and low rates of proving these crimes, and everything's going to be okay. I fear that it won't be. Okay. And it's not just federal. Most of this is state, which we can talk about. So that's my quick opening.
Thank you, Mr. Sutton. Ms. Friel?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm Jennifer Friel, and I am a defense attorney. It took me a really long time to get used to saying that.
It's okay. It's not a dirty word. It's all right.
Because I grew
all up... All shapes and sizes.
All shapes and sizes. I grew up in the U.S. Attorney's Office. This guy right here hired me, so I owe him a
great
lot.
Great hire.
Thank you. And I worked for, of course, Johnny, and then also worked under Robert Pittman, who's now a judge in town. And it was great to go to work every day, and our job was to do justice. That was the message from the top, was as an AUSA, I was supposed to go out there and do the right thing and do justice, and I really enjoyed it. But now I am on the other side, and I still feel like my job is to do justice. It's different on the defense side, and one thing I tell folks who ask me what's it like switching sides, there is more of a focus on the individual sitting across the desk from me, my client. My client is a person or often a CEO of a company, and I'm very much focused on the facts of their case, how the law applies to them. Can I find a Fourth Amendment violation in the record? How can I help this person? And I often tell tell clients, you know, my job is to hold your hand and walk you through what's going to be very difficult and hopefully get you to the best result possible. But as much as in my daily practice, I do focus on the individual, I do think it's important to talk, to zoom out and talk about the criminal justice system as a whole. Because as much as you're focused on that case and that file, we do need to do these health checks on the system. And what's more, it's not just lawyers doing and talking about this. We've all seen the headlines about progressive district attorneys being elected. We've seen the headlines about progressive district attorneys being recalled. So it's good to have these conversations. The one other point I want to make in this opening is that as much as we're talking about the critiques of our system, I do want to begin by saying the foundations are strong. We should all take pride in the foundational elements of our criminal justice system, like the right to a jury trial, like the right to counsel, no matter if you can afford one or not, the right to remain silent, the fact that there's an independent judiciary, the fact that there's a check on our district courts to the appellate courts to sometimes the U.S. Supreme Court. So our system has the strong fundamentals, but we need to make sure that it is functioning as best as it can, because the consequences really are profound for the accused, but also for, you know, the communities and often underprivileged communities that unfortunately we have seen the crime rates go up. So these are really important issues to discuss, but the bedrock is strong. We just need to make sure we don't take our eye off how to constantly improve and make it better.
Thank you, Ms. Friel. Mr. Shaw?
Is this on? Yep, there we go. Yeah, Johnny, hearing you talk about your old job made me realize I have a new dream job in life, and that's to be an independently wealthy district attorney.
Exactly.
That's what I want to be.
Exactly.
Well, I'm really excited for this panel. So I've been, you know, thinking about, talking about working in criminal justice issues from my time at the AG's office, and the Senate more on the policy side, and obviously the Department of Justice more on the, you know, executing, not literally, execution side, executive side. And I think there's actually been a bit of a sea change. Like when I started talking about these issues, working on these issues, this is a little bit closer. It was kind of during the rise of this sort of conservative criminal justice reform movement. People would be, this was around 2016. It was the latest trend, really. Everyone wanted to talk about it. It obviously, the First Step Act was passed under President Trump. It was something that Republican senators got behind, co-sponsored. And you know, even then, being kind of a lone voice in the dark of like, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? And it was very easy to be just like overruled. I think even the Federal Society kind of, you know, got drunk on conservative criminal justice reform. And I feel like we're kind of in the hangover stage now. As I start, you know, over the last year, as I start talking to people, I'm starting to see more and more like, you know, the audience is starting to sway towards like, yeah, maybe we shouldn't have done that. Maybe we need to talk about more criminal justice enforcement, stuff like that. So you know, I'm curious. Like I know Alexa had the 5 years of good times where you could talk to people about that. Now I feel like it's kind of shifting. So I'm interested in kind of this conversation from there.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Alexa?
Yeah, so a lot of my work, obviously I wasn't a prosecutor or a defense attorney, but my work at the Institute for Justice specifically dealing with a lot of the collateral consequences of the criminal justice system. You know, people trying to get their lives back on track and how did their time and their experience in the criminal justice system affect that, or, you know, what violations did they encounter as part of that system. And as we think about criminal justice and criminal justice reform, I think it's important to remember what Jennifer was just talking about, that there are people, right? At the end of the day, criminal justice in the system is to serve people, that somebody has suffered a harm, there's been a victim of a crime, but that there's also somebody who the goal is to get them back into society to be a productive member of society, right? That, for instance, when incapacitation is the only option, that is not a good day, that is not a celebration, that is a sad day. And that's not the goal, that's not what we want. So how do we approach this system, remembering that it is about people and creating a society that people can work together, that victims feel heard and that they feel safe and that society feels safe, and that we are serving people so that when they come back out of the system, They are set up to succeed and to be contributing members of society and able to do the things that we say we want, right? That they are deterred, that they are back on track. And so I think that that's, you know, an important part of the conversation is how do we set people up to do good?
Thank you. As you can see from these statements, not only are these folks incredibly qualified, they are all committed to increasing justice in our society. They come at it from different ways and different perspectives, which I think is one of the beauties of the Federalist Society for giving platforms like this to give these different views. So I thought, look, how do we approach this with these different views? And I'm just going to go through it systematically. We're going to focus on the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge. What can, if anything, can we do better in each one of those roles? So let's start with prosecutors. Some district attorney offices and U.S. attorney's offices continue to operate largely as they have been operating for years. Others have installed significant reforms. Some would say that some of those reforms are fairly dramatic. Some offices have chosen not to prosecute entire categories of offenses, or failing or refusing to seek minimal sentences for serious crimes. The experimentation continues, and the results are surfacing. So Alexa, let me start with you. What do you make of a district attorney's office, for example, that chooses not to prosecute entire categories of crimes or utilize those sentencing enhancements that are passed by the legislative branch? Does that approach constitute a separation of powers violation by an executive branch employee stepping out of their lane and undermining the legislative role? Or are they just exercising prosecutorial discretion?
Yeah, so I think that it is just an exercise of discretion, right? It's not a secret that when a district attorney is voted into office that they will be exercising their discretion, and that is what they are elected to do. I think the difference now is that it is just much more in the open, that they are making it more of a platform, letting people know that that is what they are doing. And if the policy decisions that they were making, if the way they're exercising their discretion does not reflect the will of the people, then they will suffer the consequences of that. And so I think that the fact that district attorneys are reflecting the will of the people and saying, for instance, maybe there are these laws on the books that shouldn't be laws on the books and our legislators haven't taken them off. We know how much harder it is to get a law off the books than on the books. And so we will accomplish that this way, and that is what the people are wanting. And if it wasn't, they wouldn't vote these district attorneys into office, that is just another way to understand what society wants to see from prosecutors and from the criminal justice system, what crimes they believe should be enforced, and that is a perfectly legitimate way for reform to happen in our criminal code.
Pri, any response to that?
Yeah, I think there are a few like principled and practical reasons why, you know, I guess like policy-based prosecutorial discretion is a problem. And just pointing out a few. So everyone understands that prosecutorial discretion is part of the traditional role of prosecutor. That's not controversial. But what you're seeing is you're seeing this, you know, norm of being able to make judgment calls in individual situations and individual, like, you know, whether it's priorities, whether it's resources, being turned into a, well, I have this little norm power that I used to have. I'm going to turn it into an actual rule. I'm going to start, you know, just not enforcing this law at all. I'm going to basically act as if the legislator never passed this law. I think this creates two problems. One is, in general, it undermines our society's view that we are a society of laws, a society of that believes that when our legislator does something, we've all made an agreement as a society to follow those rules. Everyone says that law is always downstream of culture, but I think this is the one situation where the law can influence culture. I think that once we start telling people that, well, look, you know what? This law we're just not going to enforce because we disagree with it. I know there's a process to get rid of it, but we're not going to follow that. I think it undermines faith in all laws. Like, well, if the DA can do that one, why not know, this other one. But I actually think there's a more practical rebuttal to be. I think the most common rebuttal you see is what Alexa said is, look, if they don't like it, they'll vote him out. You know, if this little city does not want this progressive DA, wants him to actually enforce marijuana laws or something like that, well, they'll vote him out. That's actually not how our system of government is supposed to work. And by which I mean, laws are not necessarily created by the specific jurisdiction that is electing that DA. So you have statewide laws, you have federal laws that are passed as a country, regardless of what a specific jurisdiction might want to do. You might think that's unfair, that we should have more direct democracy, that everyone should be their own little fiefdom, but that's not how our country was set up. We have a system where the federal government has made marijuana illegal. I don't care if New York doesn't want that. New York has agreed to join our union. They should be abiding by our union's laws. So the idea that just like, oh, we can just vote out someone here, I actually don't think that carries through on most things. And the third point I'll make is, so for folks who were here last year, John Ashcroft gave the Coleman lecture last year, and he had a great story. I think he gave it during his speech or maybe during his book signing, where he said that, you know, when I was AG, I directed my prosecutors to go out and find an average everyday marijuana case and prosecute it. It wasn't a priority for our department. We generally speaking would not, you know, waste resources on doing that. But we wanted the message out that, like, look, this is still a crime. It is still something that is illegal. It is still something that we disapprove of. And it is our job as prosecutors to make sure that society's disapproval is felt. And the way society passes morality judgments is through our legislature, not the executive branch in terms of, you know, criminal laws. So I do think that we lose that when we allow, like, wide-scale prosecutorial discretion.
Mr. Sutton?
Yeah, there's lots of things to say here. I guess going back to Johnny Holmes, who was the DA at Harris County for a second, he taught us a lot of things. And one of the things he said, and I'm not sure I always agreed with it, but it was, if you want to change the law, you enforce that law. Because a lot of times when it's not enforced, no one will change because, oh, well, they'll work it out at the DA's office level. Another thing he said, which I think was smart as a leader, you know, we had a bunch of prosecutors trying a lot of really hairy, violent cases, and victims had really been hurt, and we had office policies on, you know, what you could plead a murder case to and who had to approve and how you'd plead out a capital murder and how you decide how to seek death and all these things. It was very carefully crafted, but one of his rules was if following the rule results in a damn fool, what he called a damn fool result, don't follow the rule. And what that means is, I think discretion for prosecutors is really on a case-by-case basis. And I think that's one of the problems we're seeing is there are certain prosecutors that are saying, I'm never going to seek the death penalty under any circumstances, or we're never going to enforce shoplifting under $1,000 or whatever it is, and I think that's a mistake. If you want to make law, you run for the legislature and you make the law. If you want to be a DA, the law has been made and you're supposed to enforce it. But then we go back to the damn fool result law. If all of a sudden enforcing this law gives us a damn fool result, don't do that thing. You know, we use our discretion to make these decisions. And I think that's very important that we remember that, because, you know, the DA represents the community, and his job is obviously to do justice, but also to keep the community safe. And sometimes you have a DA that is almost like a second criminal defense attorney. Criminal defense attorney's job is to, you know, defend his client with, you know, zealotry and, you know, aggression within the bounds of the law. That's not the DA's job. The DA's job is to do justice, and it was beat into our head. Sometimes doing justice is walking over there, picking up a dismissal form, and dismissing the case. I mean, that's what justice demands, and you might find that out right in the middle of a case where there's new evidence that you didn't know about. But I do worry about these prosecutors that are basically making decisions that is completely contrary to the legislature, and you know, it's a recipe for chaos. So I would argue for case-by-case discretion, but remember what your job is to do, is to protect the community and do justice.
Ms. Friel?
Yeah, I agree with the premise that prosecutorial discretion should be on an individualized basis. It should be on a case-by-case basis, not these blanket rules. I do find the blanket rules to be very problematic. I'm here in Travis County, and all the DA candidates say will never seek the death penalty. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to imagine a scenario where the people of Austin might very well want you to. I mean, God forbid there were a terrorist event or a school shooting. Are you really going to take tools out of your toolbox? I think it goes against what our legislature has put in that toolbox. And again, I see it more as individualized rule. And definitely, I understand the political appeal of making these promises on the election trail of, well, I'm not going to impose marijuana. I'm not going to do the death penalty. I'm going to ignore all of these laws on the books. But one of the greatest tools of a prosecutor is finding a bad guy and then figuring out one way to get them off the streets. I mean, everyone knows the famous story of Al Capone, who was a big gangster, but he was in prison because of a tax violation. And we've had cases come through the U.S. Attorney's Office where someone was, you know, being really threatening and a very scary individual you didn't want out on your streets, and you look in your toolbox and you say, hey, you know what, they have a firearm. They aren't allowed to have that firearm. We can hit them with a 922 count. So I don't like the idea of taking tools out of the toolbox. I think that's bad for the community at large. But I do understand why these progressive politicians are saying that when they're running for DA, because I think it's simple. But criminal justice just isn't that simple in practice.
All right, let's turn from the role of the prosecutor to defense counsel. What, if any, role does a defense counsel have in encouraging reform? Are they simply at the whim and the mercy of prosecutorial discretion? What can a defense counsel do to not only maintain our justice system, but improve it and when and if necessary, reform it? Johnny?
I don't know why this just popped in my head, but maybe I shouldn't say it, but it's a story from Harris County. It may be apocryphal, but I don't think so because I know the lawyer. And and there was a first day of this new prosecutor's first day in office, and they're taking him over to court to introduce him. And literally, they open the doors to the courtroom, and I believe it's the prosecutor, it may have been the defense attorney, but the prosecutor has a defense attorney on the table and he's punching him in the face as hard as he can. That was kind of the old days in Harris County.
Good old days.
And of course,
as a defense attorney, I'm not sure.
That prosecutor went on to be a defense attorney. And
turnabout was fair play.
And he was, a very seasoned prosecutor, tried a lot of capital murder cases as a prosecutor. And then he did a lot of capital murder cases as a defense attorney. And unfortunately for some of the defense attorneys in these really, hard, hard capital murder cases, the evidence is overwhelming. The facts of the crime are just horrific. Usually the priors of the defendant are long and terrible, because we would evaluate cases where we'd only seek the death penalty on the worst of the worst cases, where there was no doubt as to guilt and no doubt as to future danger. You could prove it up. So these guys didn't have much to work with. And this defense attorney did a lot of those cases. And I just remember, many of them against me, he would just fight tooth and nail, and he had almost nothing to work with. And that is the system, even though there's not much to work with, he would just fight. And of course, obviously he's a fighter because of the earlier story. But that's the kind of defense attorney I am looking for, which is, and he's also honest and honorable. And a lot of times after the case is over, we'd all go to dinner, even though a lot of times, one of our cases was high profile, and so there was a courtroom sketch artist in the courtroom who was, sketching, and that was back before there, I guess, were cameras in the courtroom. And we were also, we were allowed, if you wanted to buy one of your portraits, you could buy one. And this attorney, and you could kind of say how you wanted to look. And he told the artist, he said, I want to be standing over Sutton with my finger right in his face screaming. And that's what he did. And I guess my point is, I'm looking for zealous, honest, fighting defense attorneys. And I guess the thing that worries me today is I see the way the world is turning a little bit, it's a little bit scary for defense attorneys, you know, because the world can turn against them. All of a sudden, Twitter's against them. All of a sudden, their whole practice can be in danger because they're representing somebody that maybe the public doesn't like. And I grew up, you know, as a prosecutor, and I was not a true believer, and I'm not a true believer on the defense side. I'm more of a, what are the facts, and let's try to get to where truth is. But, you know, the Dershowitz of the world, and there were defense attorneys that would take on these tough causes. And now I worry that those tough causes are, I'm not seeing that big group stepping up. And I have to say it's a little bit of a worry.
Jennifer, you mentioned earlier that you've fairly recently transitioned from the U.S. Attorney's Office to the defense side. It was kind of hard for you to say, my name's Jennifer Friel and I'm a defense lawyer. Hello, Jennifer. How have you viewed your new role? And now on the defense side, have your perspectives changed? And how can defense lawyers like you increase justice and help institute or execute reforms when necessary?
I think it goes to how I represent my individual clients. I do have a docket of what you would consider white collar company clients, but I also take Criminal Justice Act appointments. So I do have a broad range of drug immigration offenses. And I see my role as being a big check on the system. I mean, when I tell you I scour the record for Fourth Amendment violations, it's like a game to me. I want to see what is in there. And also, I'm really keyed in on what we call Brady. So any exonerating information or even impeachment information, I get a FBI 302 interview report. You better believe I'm going to talk to the person who sat down with that agent and figure out what's not in here. So part of being a check on the system is filing those motions to suppress. And usually if you just point something out to the prosecutor, you'll get a pretty good plea offer. So, but being willing to do that and being willing to stand up for your client. And then in the appellate arena as well, when you find a good issue and you can bring it to the Fifth Circuit. I had a recent tax case where we had, there was about 30 hours of recordings and the prosecutor played like 30 minutes and we had a pretty good argument that it was an unfair selection and it left a false impression with the jury. We got a finding that it was error. It was harmless error, unfortunately, for my client. But now there's a case out of the Fifth Circuit that other defense lawyers can use if they have the same scenario where there are a lot of recordings and only a select few are played. So yes, I think it is number one, making sure you're enforcing the rules that are found in our Constitution, and then also taking the extra time to challenge. And the final point I want to make is actually going to trial. And I haven't been defense counsel in a trial yet. For my corporate clients, I try to get deferred prosecution agreements and keep them on the witness list. But there have been some high profile acquittals recently of lawyers and clients, right? It's often the client who wants to go to trial and use the system and get it in front of a jury. The test pilot on the Boeing MAX 737 case that was acquitted, like not a hung jury, acquitted recently because he had a team of lawyers. David Gerger was part of that team. Some other headlines, the antitrust chicken producers, they got an acquittal third time around. So you had lawyers and clients who were willing to just go to trial, put it in front of a jury. And then we've all heard about the Varsity Blues scandal getting kids into college, a lot of pleas, but there was an acquittal because someone was willing to take it to the jury. So I think we could talk about it more, but as a defense lawyer, I think it's important to be willing to be the bulldog who's willing to go to trial. And the system probably could use some tweaks, in my opinion, to make trials more appealing to clients.
I tell my jurors, I mean, on that point, that, you know, our framers set up a radical system that empowers everyday citizens to step into a courtroom and be the only check and the only stop of the power of the government. And I tell them, look, I've been nominated by two presidents, and I cannot do what you're going to do. I don't get to say what happened. I don't get to find whether what the prosecutor is alleging is true beyond a reasonable doubt or not. Only you can do that. The framers gave you that power. And this is government by the people. And usually I kind of seem, you know, puff up a little bit. I can do things the judge can do. And it's true. And they need to know that. And my defense lawyers, I see so many good ones. I want to say something about that, following up on Mr. Sutton's comments. They are absolutely essential to our system of government and our criminal justice system. I am blessed to have a fantastic federal public defender's office who are true believers, and I don't say that as an aspersion, we need those people, who will fight tooth and nail. They'll do so professionally and civilly, but they are the best representation that money cannot buy. And my jurors continually tell me that afterwards. I speak to them just, hey, how'd we do as a court? What can we do better? And almost all of them say, I was really pleasantly surprised with the public defenders. I thought we lived in a system where, you know, if you couldn't afford an attorney, you were toast. And my first trial was an acquittal, not a hung jury, an acquittal. So defense counsel absolutely are essential, and to the extent, you know, any of us hear folks demonizing a lawyer just for doing his or her job within the rules, of course, you know, we need to stand up not just for that lawyer, but for our system of justice that our framers set in place. Let's step away from the defense role, and let's put the spotlight on folks like me. Let's talk about the judges. From your perspectives, former federal prosecutors, state prosecutors, practicing attorney, defense lawyers, and academics, what should judges be doing better on this front? I give you full immunity. You can say anything you want about me. I'm a little brother, so I was beaten my whole life by my older brother, so I can take it. Don't worry about me. It's an honest question. You know, most judges, I mean, hopefully all of us, we decide to do what we do because we want to increase justice in our society. And if there are things we can do better as, you know, one of the players in the system, we want to know about it. Alexa?
Yeah, so I think that the most important thing, or one of the most important things that judges can be mindful of, is not ceding their discretion to the government. So for those of us who do practice or have practiced civil rights and civil liberties work, it's no secret that if you're up against the government, you know, you're fighting an uphill battle where you'll read these briefs that are just absolute garbage, and yet they win. And we're like, how does this happen? It's like, it's the government. The government signed their name to the brief. But at least in that world, you're up against rational basis. There is a reason for why the discretion, whether or not that reason is good or bad. But there is this discretion that's given, and that's not true in the criminal justice system. There's no reason for deference to be given to the government or the AUSA's recommendation or the government's position, that these two sides should be equal and be given equal deference in decision making. And I'll give a kind of a brief example from here in Texas. I filed a lawsuit less than 6 months ago, based on a prosecutor who spent 20 years as both a prosecutor and a law clerk to the judges he was practicing before, all behind closed doors. And he was writing the judges' decisions without the defense knowing, and having these ex parte communications with the judges, being the right-hand advisor to the judges without the defense knowing. And of course, this is, we hope, an extreme example, but it is something that happened for 20 years and affected hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases. And when that prosecutor was asked about it, what he said was, the judges wanted my opinion, and then they insisted on paying me for it. And he saw nothing wrong with that behavior. And that is the system that we live in, that he felt that was okay. And the entire Midland County District Attorney's Office felt that they didn't need to say anything about it. That's the level of discretion that we have come to accept. And so I think being mindful that not only is the government not always right, but we actually live in a system where we're supposed to doubt the government and doubt when they are putting restrictions on liberty and question that, and that judges shouldn't be taking their recommendations as law, but should be questioning them and scrutinizing them and making sure that the defense is heard.
Pre?
I would say that that's not the kind of discretion that we come to accept, because the very fact that they kept it a secret, I think they knew what they were doing was wrong, would receive like essentially universal, you know, shock that you could do something like that. Because I think that when we start talking about situations by anecdote, I think we lose the bigger picture when it comes to criminal justice policy. So, when Judge Hendricks was talking about judicial discretion, that the classic example is sentencing, where there's a lot of debate over whether judges should have more discretion in sentencing individual defendants, or if they should follow guidelines that kind of are, sort of a one-size-fits-all. You know, guidelines try to take into account individual situations by having certain factors, certain, enhancements, certain ways to reduce the sentence. But for the most part, it is trying to put a national policy on how federal, at least in the federal system, how sentences are handed out. And I think we've seen a trend in recent years, actually over the last maybe two or three decades, where we want to provide more discretion to judges. Guidelines are no longer mandatory. Not only are they not mandatory, but I think a lot of people want to have situations where judges take into account a person's individual circumstances. And it sounds really good to say that. Well, like, this person's a unique, special snowflake. Why they did this versus not this. And sometimes it goes the other way. Like, sometimes someone in the judge's estimation is a terrible snowflake, and it's someone who should go to jail for longer. But I think there's two problems with this. And putting aside the idea of whether sentences should be higher or lower, that's a different debate that we can have, and I'm happy to have that debate. But there's a second question over uniformity and whether there should be uniformity in how people are sentenced in a federal system. If you do something in Texas and you're prosecuted by the federal government in Texas, you do something in Montana and you're prosecuted by the Montana federal government, should you be treated the same by the same government? It's not a local DA. It's not a situation where your local government has passed the rule. It's the feds. And the reality is today that does not happen. So I practice in the Northern District of Texas. Our judges are, for the most part, pretty heavy when it comes to the sentencing. Not as heavy as I'd like, but decently heavy. I know there's a few of you in here. I'm allowed to say that because I don't practice criminal law anymore. You should sentence more. But if you compare it to somewhere like Chicago, where for the most part, I think I saw a statistic where I think 80% of sentences, there's a downward departure of some form. You could do the same crime in Chicago that you do in Dallas and be the same human being, the same person, but because of the judge you have, you're going to go to jail for less time or more time. And that is not how our system should work. If we have to prioritize any one thing, I think the idea of knowing what you are in store for, knowing that if you commit a certain crime, you will serve this amount of time, is far more preferable to, so we're going to miss, a few situations where someone should have gotten a lesser sentence or more sentence because of their unique circumstances. But on the whole, I think we should prioritize that uniformity. And then in terms of, whether that should lead to higher or lower sentences, I think for the most part that there is a notion that the United States in general sentences more harshly than other countries. And the honest answer is that is true. You hear stories about how the United States has a higher incarceration rate than other countries. What's interesting is we generally speaking don't have the highest rate of people going to prison. It's that once they are in prison, they serve for a longer amount of time. And we could talk about, as Judge Hendricks said, in general, the United States does have a higher incidence of violent crime, but I think there's another principle here too. It is okay for society to have different values. Our country was founded and has a long history of retribution as being an important facet of our criminal justice system. And that's become somewhat of a dirty word these days, but it is okay for society to say that, look, we disapprove this action. We disapprove it strongly enough that we're going to have a punishment that's not for rehabilitation. It is not for incapacitation. It is not even to compensate a victim. It's about society's moral judgment on someone. And it's okay that our society, our country, has a harsher view of that than another country. So I think drawing those lines just as an absolute comparison of like, well, other countries sentence less, takes away from the unique aspect of America.
Johnny, what can I do better?
I doubt much, probably, but I think most judges are really good. I've been in front of a lot of good judges in a few really, really bad ones. I think consistency is obviously important. Set rules, holding both sides' feet to the fire. I was always in a lot of courts where the rules were very clear, and it was call your next, and if it wasn't there, you had a big problem. And I also came out of a system where I had judges where, you know, I'd try a murder case, and in Texas state system, you know, the jury does punishment as well. The jury would convict, we'd put on our punishment evidence, we'd argue punishment, they'd go out and deliberate, and I would literally turn around and the next voir dire panel would come in, and I'd pick the next jury on the next murder case while this jury was deliberating. Now that, you know, that'll take some years off your life. But it's also, those are judges that are not afraid to go to trial, and I would encourage judges to cling to the jury trial. I mean, I think it's very, very important. I think we sometimes take it for granted how important the jury trial is, and I know it's a pain, but boy, it's important. You know, it's always nice to have a friendly demeanor in the courtroom, but I like a judge that's got control of his court. For some reason, I'm thinking of the OJ trial, and you know, that trial lasted a year and a half, something like that. I think in Texas, that would have been an 8-week trial because there would have been rules and we would have put on evidence. I'm just trying to think of any bad. We had one judge that would sentence, you know, like 8 defendants at one time, and he'd like read real fast their rights. And I remember this poor guy was getting ready to go to prison, and the judge was talking so fast with his rights that he's supposed to understand and waive. And he says, "Excuse me, Judge, you're talking so fast, I can't understand what you're saying." And the judge screams at him, "Well, listen faster." I'm not sure that was, you know, a good example of the way a courtroom should run, but I think consistent rules, staying in their lane. I know it's very difficult to listen because not all lawyers are good. And when you see really bad lawyering, it's hard not to step in. But the more you can stay out and have really consistent rules and move, because that is another giant problem that we're seeing, especially in Houston and some of the big cities. COVID has just been an absolute catastrophe for setting back dockets. And we're just seeing huge backlogs of cases in the state and federal system, I think, too. And that is only going to be cleared by judges aggressively moving forward and having trials, because they're not going to, you know, people are not going to plead a lot of times until that trial is imminent. And so that means you're going to have great defense lawyers, prosecutors who are ready and ethical and can try cases, and judges that are not afraid of trial. You know, I mean, that's another thing. We were criticized a lot in Harris County for putting a lot of people on death row. And back in those days, if you looked at, you know, people on death row in the United States, it was state of Texas had the most, and then Harris County just by itself was number 2, and then came, you know, Florida, Georgia, you know, whatever else. And people said, that's too much. But I was a district court chief, and I would usually see 10 to 12 death eligible capital murders every year. And you know, Houston was a violent place, and we would very carefully choose those cases that were only, you know, absolute no doubt as to guilt, absolute no doubt as to future danger, and it was, you know, a lot of decisions made into that. So it was very careful. But the judges, the prosecutors, and the defense attorneys knew how to try those cases, so they were able to move those cases along. Where in most jurisdictions, a capital, especially for death, will throw the lawyer and the judge for a loop. And but I think our judges in Texas are by and large fantastic, and you know, I think just let the trial happen, but feet to the fire, as I'm sure you do already.
Jennifer, is there anything you'd like to add?
I would just say, you know, generally I don't want judges being reformers. I mean, you don't want the umpire reforming baseball, but I do think the one thing I would say is I have been in courtrooms where it's very obvious a judge doesn't want a jury trial. They are overworked, they have a crazy docket, and you know, they cannot influence a plea, but it can become clear that they don't want a jury trial. So I guess that would be the one thing I would say, sort of a theme, is that jury trials are super important to the whole system, and to the extent judges are discouraging that, it's a problem. And then, but I also think at the appellate level, it's important that our appellate judges are also emboldened to challenge the system. I think that goes back to some of the what you were saying about maybe the government gets a little extra credit when they're in front of the court. And I think I got some of that as an AUSA arguing. I walked in with more credibility, and I think it's important that our courts who are checking on the district courts, be mindful that there could be really good reasons that to hold the government's feet to the fire.
All right, let's turn to incarceration rates. We're a little short on time, so we'll skip the sentencing guidelines. I know you were all just waiting to talk about the sentencing guidelines. You'll be glad to know I teach a sentencing law course at Texas Tech School of Law. If you want to talk to me about it, I'd be glad to talk to you about it. But incarceration rates, we hear about those often. Some are concerned with America's incarceration rates. We've often heard the phrase mass incarceration. Others, less so. What, if anything, do these rates tell us about our criminal justice system and any necessary reforms? Mr. Shaw, you mentioned some of this previously, and you've given a presentation entitled Texas's Under-Incarceration Problem. Tell us about that.
It's actually a national under-incarceration problem. I live in Texas, so I care more about Texas.
So you've broadened it even more.
Yeah. Okay. look, it's one of those things where I think everyone who's kind of paying attention to current political climate or, you know, watches TV is seeing a lot of, you know, depictions of increases in violent crime. I mean, the crazy examples of people looting stores, of, you know, the massive uptick in carjacking, stuff like that. It's omnipresent in the media these days. I do think after criticizing policy making by anecdote, I really should just rely on that. I should have some numbers. And as a lawyer, I didn't memorize them. I was told there'd be no math here, but I did print them out. But because the numbers are pretty stark here. And I think it's important to understand that we actually do live in a world where we have under incarceration in society compared to where we were even 10 years ago. So compared to 10 years ago, incarceration rates are down 20%. In 2019, we had the lowest incarceration rate that we've had since 1995. And for folks old enough to remember that, again, maybe it's correlation, maybe not causation, but the reality is, I think crime rates started dropping around that same time. And now we're starting to see crime rates go up. I think there is a myth that our country over-incarcerates people, that we don't give people a second chance, that we are punishing low-level, non-violent drug offenders. The reality is 60% of state inmates are in jail because of murder, rape, assault, robbery, or burglary. Drug offenses are less than 15% of that. And that's all drug offenses. That includes violent drug offenses. I'm focused on state prisons because the vast majority of our prison population is actually in state jail. Only about 10 to 12%, I think, are in federal prison. And again, these are the worst of the worst offenses. And our lengthy sentences are only reserved for those most serious violent crimes. But even then, and these numbers actually I didn't know until I actually had to look it up, about 20% of convicted murderers and nearly 60% of those convicted for rape or sexual assault serve less than 5 years. And I think, again, no matter what you think about what a punishment should be, as a society, I think we have a visceral reaction to hearing that someone who's convicted of rape, sexual assault, or murder is in jail and serving less than 5 years. And again, the idea of our country not giving people second chances, the reality is our criminal justice system gives people second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth chances. One of my biggest shocks when I joined the U.S. Attorney's Office and started reviewing criminal files was that we'd see the page of someone who's been convicted of some violent offense, and we'd go through their criminal history. And not just the convictions, but seeing the arrest rates. Every single criminal defendant that we picked up would have been arrested, I want to say at least a dozen times. Maybe I was seeing the worst of the worst, but I've talked to most of my line prosecutors, and that's what you'd see. And the numbers bear that out. So if you look at someone who's been arrested for a homicide or shooting, they, generally speaking, have 12 prior arrests. 20% of them have more than 20 arrests. There are people dead today because we did not understand that these people probably should have been in jail much, much longer. Only about 40% of state felony convictions, result in any jail time at all. 40% of people convicted for a felony do not see jail time as part of their sentence. I am happy to have a debate over whether we have, at the margins, certain people who are convicted of certain crimes. We should reform policy laws, we should reform drug laws. Even if I don't agree with that position, I'm willing to trade you that if we could have greater enforcement on violent crime, greater enforcement, longer sentences, And the 2 points I'll note there. One is a prosecutor I was talking to actually just a couple months ago had this just bristled at the idea of drug crimes being nonviolent. And I think that's something that we're starting to see now for two reasons. One is the rise in fentanyl. The reality is that anytime someone is dealing fentanyl, they're committing a violent crime because you could die any moment. From one use of fentanyl, you will die. And the second thing is actually a little bit more, you know, practical. The drug industry works, just as a practical matter, on commission and the threat of force. You are selling drugs under the threat of force to someone, whether that's a supplier, whether that's a community where you want to sell. You are controlling that territory. You're selling people. You are threatening people with force there. So the idea that it's a nonviolent crime is I think, kind of meaningless. And the last point is, so traditionally when you're in law school, you learn about three reasons for sentences. One is rehabilitation, one is retribution, and one is basically deterrence. And those are the three that I learned about in law school. There's actually a fourth, and that's incapacitation. I know Alexa talked about it, and it used to be a more fundamental, it used to be a bigger part of our criminal justice system. The idea that there are people that the mere fact that we are keeping them in jail is keeping society safer. It's not deterrence exactly. Deterrence is about deterring other people based on the sentence we're talking about. We're talking about an individual who, because we have decided to lock them up for 20 years, there are people who are safer out today. I think that is something that is being ignored. Even if you think that we were focusing on too much in the past, right now we have situations where people who are being arrested are being let out on bond, getting lower sentences, and the result of that is they're out there committing more crimes. I think incapacitation does have to be a factor in our analysis, and it's not something we can just like toss aside.
Alexa?
Yes, so I think one thing I didn't hear in the numbers is what the recidivism rate was for those people who were committing violent crimes, or they maybe served, 5 years for their crime. Are those the people who are coming back committing the same crimes? The people who have been arrested 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times, but what are those crimes they're being arrested for? Is it a person, you know, repeated speeding tickets? What are the crimes that are being repeated? That so that when we look at these numbers, like in that broad scale, we're not really getting the information we need. As you already previewed, correlation is not causation. And when we talk about the justifications of the criminal justice system, I agree that incapacitation is an important part of the criminal justice system and is an unfortunate but necessary part of the criminal justice system. And if we talk about there being a problem of under-criminalization and people not serving long enough sentences, is that the answer? Is that all of these people who have committed one act, and I don't mean to undermine the effect on victims of these crimes, but that they would just be incapacitated for forever, that cannot be the goal, and the aim is to just remove people entirely from society without giving the opportunity to do better. And certainly there comes a point where we understand that that's not possible, or maybe there are some person that are instances where it is one instance is enough to say, you are too much of a risk to society. But when we talk about the other justifications, I think the biggest justification we hear about is deterrence, and that there are two forms of deterrence, specific and general deterrence. And we know that specific deterrence has diminishing effects over time, right? That there is certainly being punished. There are consequences for your actions. To an extent can be effective and can keep people from committing future crimes when they are released to society. But I'm sad that Professor Hobwood couldn't be here with us today, because he would tell us about the place where people learn to become criminals is in prison. That is where they learn, when they are released, they don't have the tools that they have been given are tools to continue to commit crimes. And so that the longer amount of time in jail is actually not productive. And it doesn't keep people from committing crimes when they get out. Instead, it teaches them tools when they get out and they do not have the resources, the ability, they can't get the licenses they need to drive a truck and be a truck driver and earn a living, because we've got these collateral consequences, you know, and they can't rebuild their lives. But what they have learned is how to be an effective criminal. So specific deterrence only works to some extent. But then you also have general deterrence, which is just a fundamentally flawed justification. So I see two of my friends here on the second row, that to keep Ari from committing crimes, I'm going to put Connor in prison for 3 years. That just strikes you as wrong in a free society, that I'm going to imprison one person to try to keep another person from committing crimes. And we know that doesn't work, that people don't avoid committing crimes because they don't want to spend time behind bars. They don't commit crimes because society and their conscience and morality tells them that those things are wrong. And so I think we need to be more thoughtful about our justifications, and are we actually serving the goals that we say we want to serve?
Johnny, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a very complicated and complex issue. One point I want to make is that closure rates on violent crime are dropping. That's one thing we've been very good in the United States, especially in murders, in being able to find out who killed somebody and prove it. And when I was U.S. Attorney, I did a lot of work in Mexico with the Mexicans and the Colombians, and you know, especially in Mexico, their closure rate is terrible. And you know, they would beat me up all the time. Johnny, you got to stop all these guns coming south. And I would say, we're doing our best. We're trying to stop guns, and you know, and all that. But at some point, especially because I'm very good friends with these Mexican attorney generals, and they really are heroes working with no budget in dangerous, dangerous situations. But at some point, I'd say, hey guys, look, guns are legal in the United States, and you know, we're having a hard time stopping tons of marijuana that a dog can smell, and guns going south is one thing. Why don't you just, guns are illegal in Mexico, just put some people in prison. I mean, a 50 cal ought to get you 20 years in prison in Mexico. And they just couldn't do it because, you know, problems. And a lot of times the military was making the arrest and the evidence was not collected right. But incarceration, I mean, accountability is something we have to have. Whether it needs to be some long sentences, I'm not sure. I may agree with Alexa that I've never been for these super long sentences. Even life in prison, I mean, I guess we have it now. I've never been fond of it because I've spent so much time in prisons. Probably when I was, you know, in the governor's office, I probably visited 40, 50, 60 units. And I'd encourage all of y'all to spend a couple of days in a prison because, and especially the judges.
Visits.
Because
as a volunteer.
Y'all already do this.
I mean, in all honesty, it's part of our training. You go to a Bureau of Prison facility, you tour it, you step into a prison cell, you meet with different rehabilitation program managers,
right.
And it's sobering.
Yeah, because you got to know that when you send a 21-year-old kid off to do 40 years in prison, this is where he's going to be. Now, not always, because there's different levels. A lot of times he'll be driving an 18-wheeler dressed all over the place. But anyway, the point is we've got to have accountability. We got to have, you know, safe, secure prisons. By and large, TDCJ, I think, is one of the greatest agencies in the history of state government. I mean, they do so many amazing things and you only hear about them when something goes wrong. But every day they get whatever it is, 120,000 people up, fed, working, you know, reading, fed again, put to bed, and no one died that day. I mean, it's just amazing. But I'm not sure about these super long sentences. What we found is if we can get people past the age of 40, a lot of this craziness starts to settle down. And also, you know, we do need to believe in redemption. I think that one thing we need to get better about, I'm a big believer in prisons, and we need to start incarcerating these aggravated robbers and the things we're seeing in Houston. The violent crime is going up, and it's going to kill people, and it's going to kill minorities the worst. So that is where the impact is going to be. But having said all that, when people come out of prison, we have to have some grace, and we've got to people who are felons, and even if they're felons for, you know, robbery or murder, they've got to be given a chance in this society. And that's what Alexa is saying. If they can't get out, they can't get a job, they can't get a place to live, all they know is crime. It's like, well, I have no opportunity. So that's where I would encourage us to be a little braver, a little less risk adverse until something goes wrong, to do that. And then again, we've got to do something with police, because that's a big worry of mine, is I think the police, I really see in the future, especially for local cops, especially in jurisdictions where they're not very well respected, like, you know, LA or Minneapolis or places where they've been, you know,
demonized.
Yeah, it's bad. It is bad. And when those, you know, I prosecuted a ton of cops. In fact, I'm kind of infamous for prosecuting police. And CNN never calls me, you know, someone who successfully prosecuted police. It's interesting how that never happens. But we really need to have our police force be fantastic. They've got to be honorable, and they've got to be good. And I fear that we're really dropping the ball on that. And the incarceration, we just need to be careful about how we do it. And I think TDCJ in Texas is pretty good, but we don't want that pendulum to swing so much, because back when I graduated high school, 740 people got murdered in 1979 in Houston. Nobody knows that. That's a big number. I felt safe. I was running around the city throwing water balloons at every car down on Westheimer, and didn't even think that, there were people being murdered every day, twice a day. So anyway, not sure what that means, but I know we got to move.
You're doing great. All right, we do want to leave time for questions, but I want to ask one final question to the panelists, and then we're going to open it up. But please, to the extent you can, keep your comments brief so we can hear from these folks. And Jennifer, I'm going to start with you. We heard from Judge Eskridge and Judge Starr and their beautiful comments about Ken Starr, that, you know, we have a republic, of course, if we can keep it. The legitimacy and the durability of our republic depends in large part on the consent of the governed and our citizens' continued willingness to be part of that government and to place trust in it. It feels at times that trust in the system is at an all-time low. Maybe that's an echo chamber, maybe that's social media, maybe that's wrong. But nevertheless, maintaining and hopefully, you know, incrementally increasing confidence in our system is essential. What can we do to either restore it, maintain it, or improve it? Jennifer?
Yeah, my answer to this question is in many ways probably influenced by the fact that I have three school-age children, but I strongly believe that we need to be educating the next generation about what our courts do and about our system and about the Fourth Amendment and about their constitutional rights if they ever do encounter the police. I was actually moved by the fact that Ken Starr spoke at an Anacostia school. We all need to be thinking about the next generation and what they're learning about our system of government. There are some good programs in Texas. I'm part of the Texas Historical Society, and there's an education system about our courts that's actually pretty booming in Harris County, and we're trying to spread it. So there are programs out there, but I think that's a key part of it. And the other thing I will add is I really appreciate the scholars and the folks like at Georgetown who are really doing the research, because my day job is representing individuals who are in trouble. I don't have the time to do the research that's happening at our universities. And I think that research is important. And I think there's going to be some good data about the length of sentences that will come from compassionate release during COVID. A lot of inmates were released early because of COVID conditions. Are they reoffending? Who's following them? What's happening? And then, of course, during the Obama administration, there was this massive clemency program. 1,715 different individuals had their sentences lowered. Who's following them? What are we gonna learn about that data? Because it seems to me that I agree with Pri in a lot of ways that we've got to be putting violent offenders in jail, and we have to make sure these crime rates don't go back to what we saw in the 80s and when you couldn't visit New York City as a tourist. Houston was pretty dangerous place. But the length of sentences, I think, is where some reform is perhaps warranted. And we'll see what these compassionate release cases show.
Yeah, and just quickly on data, the Sentencing Commission has, more data than any of us could ever take. But you can identify type of offender, to go to Alexa's comments, but what kind of crime are we talking about, and recidivism rates, length of sentence and recidivism rates, criminal history and recidivism rates. We have data on all of that. And it's right there. Any comments on this topic?
Yeah, on whether we should worry about society as a whole and if things are going bad. Yeah, it's a great way to end. The honest answer is yes, I think so. A lot of people think government should play different amounts of roles in our lives, whether you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, libertarian, liberal. But I think everyone agrees that one of the core functions of our government is to protect people from violence, from other people that want to do you harm, whether that's the traditional army and the foreign government, police in your homes, whatever it may be. And I think a lot of people these days are starting to worry about that fundamental promise from government that they are able to protect you. And I think there's a lot of different causes for that. Some of it's society-based, some of it's rules, some of it's individual politicians, some of it's, different things. I think, to leave on a slightly better note, pendulums do swing, and I do think that this is a situation where the pendulum is starting to swing in the right direction. It probably has to get a little bit worse before it gets better. But for those of us who grew up as 90s kids, 2000s kids, the reality was society was safer back then. Things were better back then in terms of everything was better, but that society as a whole in terms of criminal justice and safety was better. I think things have gotten pretty bad in the last couple of years about what people are worried about, what people are seeing. There's a lot of big picture examples of recalls of DAs. I actually think those are somewhat one-offs, but in general, I think you're going to start seeing people caring about their safety, caring about the fact that, my catalytic converter was stolen and it's going to take me 3 months to get it replaced because everyone's catalytic converter has been stolen and they're just going to sell me back the one they stole from someone else. As it starts affecting people's daily lives, they are going to wake up and pay attention to it, and then we will have a situation where reform could actually happen. So that's my hope, at least.
Alexa?
So I think, to the question of, how do we keep our republic, and in the context of the criminal justice system, is making sure the scales are even. So I think ensuring that there is accountability on all sides. Johnny mentioned that we have to hold criminals accountable, but we also have to hold the government officials responsible for effectuating the criminal justice system accountable. So in that example that I gave earlier of this prosecutor who was violating due process for decades, right? He is now has the privilege, likely, of prosecutorial immunity. And there's judicial immunity, and of course, qualified immunity, and all of these doctrines that protect the government at the same time that we're enforcing these extreme rules against people. And so when the government fails, they have to also be held accountable, and that gives legitimacy to the system. And I think in a way it breeds goodwill to know that the prosecutor who is working on your case is seeking to serve justice. And when they don't, there are consequences for that that allows people to know that they are in a legitimate system. And when you know you're in a legitimate system, it is a more effective system. And this doesn't mean that we let prosecutors and judges and police officers and every other government employee get sued for every little thing. But it does mean that we allow for there to be a way to hold people accountable and that we do it in earnest.
Johnny?
Yeah, that's a challenge, and that's something Alexa said before, and this is really tough because when a prosecutor acts badly, and there's some criminal behavior and bad behavior and stupid behavior, but they're usually one-offs, and they usually can be taken care of through elections, through discipline inside the offices. In Department of Justice, we have, you know, OIG investigations, and I'm forgetting the name.
What, OPR
is, you know, personal response. You know, they come in and they really grade your paper hard. And it was a little frustrating for me sometimes because they'd be coming from Vermont, you know, grading our paper in El Paso, where we had undercovers in Juarez in the cartel, and surprise, surprise, something went wrong. But then we're being judged by Vermont standards. So I guess my point is we got to be very careful of tearing down this stone wall. You know, Chesterton said, if you come to an ancient stone wall in an ancient forest and you have no idea why it's there, tearing it down might not be the right thing to do. Find out why that stone wall is there, and then after a time, you might want to tear it down, but you might also discover why it's there. And prosecutor immunity is, and judge immunity, all these things are really important, because I promise you, these are very difficult jobs. I mean, I used to have 10 to 15 cases set for trial every Monday, and the judge would say, oh, we're going to trial number 8. And, you know, there wasn't like, I can't be ready. It's like, you're ready. And so I guess to get people to sign up to do that, they can't be in danger of losing their livelihood or going to prison easily, okay? If they commit a crime, they are going to go to prison. I mean, that's just the way it is. And I put plenty of law enforcement officers, federal agents, and public officials in prison. I think over 75. And you can Google me, and I'm infamous for that. But having said all this, we really live in an amazing time. I know our country's kind of heading down the toilet at the moment, but I think it's going to be okay. I really do. I think it's going to be okay. But y'all are going to be the ones that have to fight for freedom. I mean, liberty. I mean, that is really that's kind of the point of this organization. It's just hold to the Constitution, fight for liberty. Not every idea is great. Let's kind of hold on what we have. But I'm encouraged. I mean, you know, it's a constant battle. And also, don't believe the cable news. That's the other problem is, you know, so much of information we get is just flat out false. You know, I mean, the people are connecting dots. They have no idea what DOJ is doing. I mean, it's just they don't know. And we won't know for a long time. And when people say, well, Johnny, where can I get information? Where do you get your information? And of course, the unfortunate answer for them is I call my friends in those locations and they tell me what's happening. But most people can't do that. Yeah. You know, they've got to listen to the news, which has no idea. But I think that's going to adjust too. We're going to have people who are going to go into the media, you know, the Andy McCarthy types, who are going to like, okay, I kind of know what I'm talking about. And he's not going to connect dots. He can't connect. So anyway.
All right. Questions? Hi, Arif at IJ. I'd like to ask a question that hits a couple of the themes I think we've heard throughout, so I'll try to keep it consistent with the panel. Pre made a good point. Prosecutors, you know, are there to protect people, especially their rights. And Alexa makes a great point that you want an even playing field there. There is no stacking of the deck on one side or the other. What damage do you think it's doing over the long term when prosecutors step out of criminal court and step into civil court, where there's no presumption of innocence, no right to counsel, and where they start filing lawsuits against people's property who have never been arrested or convicted of anything, and where once they forfeit the property, it goes right to their own budgets to help pay for salaries of the actual people who do the seizures and the forfeitures. It strikes me that incentives really matter, and if we're gonna have a system of criminal justice that is honorable, honest, equal, and that's designed to protect rights, that straying out of that criminal court and going into civil courts has all sorts of collateral consequences for the architecture that the Constitution demands. I'm just curious on some thoughts on that.
Civil asset forfeiture, especially pretrial, anyone can speak
to that? I mean, I was going to say, I'm probably a little bit more open to civil asset forfeiture. Obviously, I do think it's one, like what Jennifer was saying, it's a toolbox. Abuses are prevalent in many places, and a lot of it is how the incentive structure is created. The incentive should be to remove ill-gotten gains from people who are doing bad things, but when you start throwing on, well, this might go to your budget, it does skew that one incentive. You know, the idea I always had is I think that Texas police departments should be allowed to engage in civil asset forfeiture, and every fund they seize should go to the San Francisco Police Department's budget. And the San Francisco Police Department should be able to engage in civil asset forfeiture, and that should go to, you know, pick your, you know, El Paso's pretty left, like, you know, I don't know, Midland's police budget. Or even worse, like, let's do something like this. Like, you should go to fund defense lawyers. Like, that's terrible. I don't want to fund defense lawyers. But the reality is, like, I think being able to focus on the correct incentives and allow that tool to be used for that goal is something that we should focus on. So A, having the money go to a better place. B, if we're gonna reduce civil asset forfeiture, let's make criminal asset forfeiture significantly easier both to recover and to then use. So like, there's different ways. So, thank you.
Yeah, a lot of my practice is defending against asset seizures. So I know where you're coming from, but I also did asset work as an AUSA, and you're right, the incentive structure is off, but one thing that gets lost in the civil asset world is sometimes as a prosecutor, my discretion would be like, you're an idiot, you made a terrible mistake, I'm not gonna prosecute you, but you can't keep the 20 grand that you made from this terrible mistake. So the civil asset forfeiture is actually, you know, being lenient. So there are scenarios where I don't think it should be completely eliminated as a tool, but tweaks to the incentive structure I think are warranted for sure. And you're right, because it is so criminal adjacent, but yeah, that burden of proof is significantly lower. So maybe that's where we tweak it, is to get a higher burden. And in those situations where it is part of leniency, usually it's, you don't end up in court, it's part of some sort of agreement, but you do have to have the agreement and the laws that will support that. So it is a tool that I don't want to see completely eliminated, but it needs some tweaks.
I see that we have another questioner. Looks like one of the newest members of the Federalist Society. Nobody knows who this person is. Identify yourself, sir. What can we answer for you?
Tools. I get nervous about tools. And my question is, it's not that, obviously there are a bunch of tools and you use them, but the danger is that if the, I'll take the Al Capone case you brought up, and I remember my mother years ago saying, you know, that was ridiculous. I mean, yes, he was awful, but that's not, you know, they're getting him for something, they're using something that's not really about the core of what he did. And the danger is, if you have enough tools, you have enough tools to get the bad guys, and that's great. And you also have enough tools to get the reasonably okay guys, and that's really dangerous. So talk about that for a second.
That is where the discretion comes in, and where our system of checks and balances should also come in. I'm sure it was true at the DA's office. It was certainly true at the U.S. Attorney's office. Every indictment I drafted got approved by supervisors, you know. And of course, whatever happens in court, you're being checked by a defense lawyer, you're being checked by the judge, and then you've got the appellate court. But you're right. It is a very powerful position to be a prosecutor. Richard Durbin, who was the crim chief when I was there, literally said, listen, you're entering a job where people have made the mistakes, but you'll be part of the machine that will ruin their lives, mm-hmm. right? Like, they chose to commit a crime, but you're part of a machine that will ruin their lives. And he said it in a way to make us all realize how, I mean, discretion is so very important.
Alexa, did you want to say something about this?
Yeah, so I think that we agree that it comes down to checks and balances, but I think that this was the problem that I was discussing earlier, is that there are not enough, or they're not utilized the right way. So it is wonderful that a supervisor reviews an indictment, but it's just a fellow prosecutor, right, who has the same...
You have a grand jury, too.
Yes. But that you... and then when you're in court, right, that the judge is going to default to the government did this right. That is the starting position generally, is the government did this right, the government is good, and they're doing something good. And that there should just be more skepticism, more I think Jennifer used the phrase, hold their feet to the fire and do that and challenge them. And it's not because you assume that they're bad, though our founder certainly did. It is because that's how you make sure you get to the right result. People who are confident in what they're doing and know that they're doing the right thing, they're fine with being challenged. It's a good thing to do and to check. And so we should just be doing more of that and making sure that somebody wasn't taken advantage of to get to their plea, for instance.
Yeah, Johnny, want to say something?
Yeah, real quick. This is a gigantic worry, and I've been worried for this problem for a long time. And again, I came out of the state system to the governor's office, to the federal level at the very highest levels. I mean, I did DOJ transition. Me and Ted Cruz were the two people. So you really see government at the highest levels. And on the federal side especially, these quote tools are usually just these sledgehammers that come down on your head. And I would beat into my people's head, you know, what Jennifer was saying, what Durbin was saying, which is humility. I mean, you got to walk in this job with humility because you have so much power. And when the legislatures or the Congress gives this, quote, tool to a prosecutor, it's very tempting not to use it. It's like saying, you know, if I'm a cop and they're going to give me an AR-15, I mean, and I got to go with a 9mm, I'm going in with the right tool, okay? And if I can go in with a robot that's got C4 on the end, maybe I'm going to just drive that robot up and boom. So you got to be very careful on how this works. And especially like 924C, like a gun, there's a gun charge you put on top of people that, you know, if you commit a federal crime, okay, bad. If you commit it with a gun, you got 5 years stacked on top. If you use the gun, like point it at somebody, now you got 7 years stacked on top. And if, God forbid, you shoot somebody, you got 10 years stacked on top. So, I mean, again, the point is we got to stop violent crime. Well, the violent crimes happen down at state level mainly. But now there are these giant tools, and I guess what I would do is I would resist those tools. And I've seen it for many years. When I came to the governor's office, I thought I'd be doing all these wonderful things. All I did was play 95% defense against my own party, who was coming up with these brilliant ideas, like they wanted to make cow tipping a first degree felony or something. I mean, it was...
You gotta get them young.
All right.
Sorry, just quickly. I mean, I think it's all well to like talk about prosecutorial discretion and about other tools of the fire, but look, no matter how good a system we have, there's gonna be either over-inclusion or under-inclusion. That's just gonna happen. And I think that there is this perception because the most obvious like public examples are wrongfully convicted people, stuff like that, where I think our policymakers, or at least I think our storytelling always focuses on the over-inclusion, that we're being over-inclusive in situations. I think an argument can be made that under-inclusion is also a problem. The idea that society as a whole, the safety of society as a whole, the classic formulation, I'd rather have 10 guilty men go free than one innocent man go to jail. I mean, okay, what about 100? What about 1,000? What about 100,000? That's a great saying, but as a practical matter, like, society has to make judgment calls. We will occasionally get it wrong, and we can't create rules to prevent that wrong from happening if it paralyzes us from having public safety.
So, all right, last question.
So with respect to prosecutorial power, we talk about the beauty and strength of the jury system, but we also know how few actual criminal trials actually get to a jury. And one of the reasons for that potentially is the threat of stacking sentences, additional, making it's such high risk for a defendant to
trial take, penalty.
Yes, to actually take their matter to trial in front of a jury. And so they don't exercise that right. They can't exercise that right because the risks are so massive. So to what extent is that really a real right, the right to jury trial, with respect to what prosecutors very frequently do during the plea bargaining stage in order to extract a guilty plea?
Anyone?
I agree 100%. It's a giant problem, and how you undo it means you have to undo some of these really draconian laws and penalties. And that's going to be very difficult. And that's why when I was playing defense for the governor, you know, the politicians want to go back and they said they increased punishment. They made a new crime. I mean, you know, every session there'd be like 40 new crimes. We didn't need any new crimes.
I mean, you know, we know the crimes. We've known them for 150 years. All we need to do is have discretion with judges and prosecutors and good criminal defense attorneys and a reasonable system. It's going to be a Nixon goes to China situation where some rock rib conservative who's put a lot of people on death row can say, well, we got to bend this back. We got to bend this back. And it's going to be hard.
Alexa.
Yeah, so I have two real brief suggestions for how we could reduce that risk. One is to remove the right of prosecutors to engage in puffery in plea bargaining, something they can do now. Of course, they can't lie, but they can engage in puffery. That shouldn't be the case. There shouldn't be puffery or boasting or overselling your position when you are talking about taking away somebody's liberties. And the other thing that we can do is we extend Brady to the plea bargaining process and make that a requirement that if there is exculpatory evidence, you must hand it over during plea bargaining. And that is, it's not a fix, but it is something that will help even the playing
field. I like that idea.
That's a good idea.
Thank you.
I was supposed to be the negative, right? No, I had a debate just a couple months ago with Clark Neely on plea bargains, and I think his view is we should get rid of plea bargains entirely. And Clark and I came to an agreement that I think we should foist on the entire American people. We'll get rid of plea bargaining completely. Every case has to go to a jury. But we're going to now fund our criminal justice system about 2,000 more, you know, in terms of absolute dollars. So, like, we need to hire 2,000 more, you know, 2,000x more prosecutors. We need to pay jurors more. We need to do all that sort of stuff. Because the idea of people that want to say, oh, we should just like reduce plea bargaining, we should reduce, any time you're going to do that and you're unwilling to put more money in the system, what you're actually saying is we actually want to prosecute less crimes. We want to prosecute, you know, less things. So the idea of doing Brady materials before a plea, I actually think is a terrible idea unless we fund it. It's not a terrible idea in theory, but unless we fund it, because the reality is you have a certain number of people you can prosecute. If you need to prepare for trial for all of it, or you need to prepare Brady for it, you are going to bring less of those cases. I will call out a specific court here, which is the Northern District of Texas. There are some judges who say that when you bring an indictment or when you're ready to go, you need to be ready to go to trial by a certain period
of time.
That's
Judge Sparks here in Austin. Oh, that too. Same thing.
And like, you need to have your Brady materials ready, or you have to give your disclosures ready right at the moment. Do you know what the reality is then? We either bring less cases to that judge because we are going to prosecute less people in that court. We know for a fact that this defendant is going to settle. We know for a fact that he's going to plea. But if we need to do all that work for no reason, just to bring a charge against him, we're going to bring less charges.
Interesting.
So I'm happy to get rid of plea bargains. I'm happy to do all that sort of stuff, as long as it doesn't mean we're prosecuting less people as a result.
Interesting. I've not heard that perspective before, and this is the last thing I'll say. So I have that requirement in my scheduling order, and I have more criminal cases than any other judge in the district. Now, maybe there'd be even more, right? Who knows? All right, please join me in thanking this wonderful panel.